avoid the spread of errors throughout your computation. This is the way that we actually achieve efficient computation. Third thing that we'll be talking about is ancillary states, that is ancilla, and these aid computation in a variety of ways. Of course, as you may have suspected, looking at the title, the real themes today will be the use and construction of ancilla with homogeneous errors. In the first half of the talk, we're going to be talking mainly about using these things, and then in the second half, we'll be talking about constructing. Before I get to that, though, let me quickly run over some background. So there are four common ways of achieving fault tolerance that I've listed here on this slide. The first is the use of transversal gates. Note that here I'm using transversal to mean just that the gates don't couple qubits within a block. So there's no assumption here about them being uniform. There's some debate, I guess, as to whether that's a necessary component of the word. And so I just find my own word that I'll be using later, which is homogeneous, to refer to operations that are both that both don't couple qubits and are the same order qubit. Second means of achieving fault tolerance is through repetition. And this is simply the idea that if you have some measurement whose outcome crucially determines the success or failure of your computation, and you have the option of repeating it, you do so. Right? The third way is a distinctly quantum mechanical trick in which rather than applying some gate that it may turn out we have no convenient method of fault tolerantly implementing, rather than applying some gate directly to the data, we can instead prepare an ancilla where the gate has been applied to the ancilla, and then teleport, in some sense teleport the data under the gate. In order to do this, though, we need to have these ancilla prepared. And it's in making ancilla both for this purpose and for use in error correction where we use the fourth method of fault tolerance, which is the expenditure of qubits. And now just how many qubits you expend is going to depend strongly on what kind of encoding that you're using. Two popular kinds of encoding are concatenated or block coding. In concatenated coding, the state is encoded in levels using some relatively small or simple base code. So in the zeroth level, you're taking physical qubits and you're encoding them into logical qubits at the step up. And then you take those logical qubits and you in turn encode those into second level logical qubits and so forth. This is as opposed to block coding, in which you take some large number of physical qubits and you encode them directly into your sort of uppermost level of encoding. So if you just look directly at the crash probabilities as a function of the number of physical qubits used in the encoding, it seems like block coding is a much better deal. This exponent here on the end is less than 1. And so the crash probability will decrease faster for block codes. The problem with this is that we don't actually know any efficient way of making ancilla of an arbitrary size for block codes. For this reason, thresholds have typically been calculated as using the idea of concatenation. Roughly speaking, a concatenation threshold is just the physical error rate such that the encoded error rate for some particular procedure is less than the unencoded error rate. This is a very sort of fuzzy thing to be saying, though, and complications abound. The first that you can, well, one that you can see immediately is that there are many different kinds of encoded and unencoded errors on physical qubits and encoded qubits. And so your encoding may do interesting things like increase some of them or decrease others. You may have a case like this where you start out in some zeroth level, with some zeroth level unencoded qubits, and the total probability of an error decreases, but say the error becomes a lot more messy. In this case, X errors. You start out with physical qubits that have primarily X errors, and after encoding, you have a lower total error rate, but now you have X, Y, and Z errors. Another problem that comes quickly to mind is that the idea of good qubits, that is, when something isn't an error, doesn't really map perfectly from level to level. If you look at the zeroth level, or unencoded good qubits, good really just means perfect. If the qubit's good, there's nothing wrong with it. Here at the bottom, I have an illustration, though, for four-qubit code, which wouldn't hold much in the way of data, but an illustration for a four-qubit code as to what good qubits might look like at different levels. So at the zeroth level, a good qubit is just perfect, which I've represented here by yellow. But at the first level, for a four-qubit code, a first-level qubit, well, a quarter of it might be wrong. And you can repeat this process going up level after level, and you see that by the fifth level of encoding, a good qubit doesn't necessarily have any physical qubits that aren't in error. And this, we may feel this is kind of a hint that if what we're trying to do is use the mapping of level 0 to level 1 qubits, that we should be very careful when actually what we're trying to show is that any, say, level 4 qubit to level 5 qubit or higher maps in the same way. That is, the error rate decreases in the same way, even though these qubits in some sense aren't as good as they were when we did the original analysis. Now, these things can be dealt with, and they have been, in the production of rigorous thresholds. Rigorous thresholds bypass these problems basically by a very careful analysis of worst-case scenarios. The higher threshold results that you see are typically threshold estimates, and threshold estimates result from stochastically generating Pauli errors in the circuit and propagating them forward such that you can see the sort of end result of the Pauli errors on your circuit. I, in particular, was interested in thresholds and threshold estimates as a function of the error model, though. And neither of these methods are particularly well suited to this. This method, because worst-case scenarios typically assume a worst-case error model. And the second case, because I don't actually want to be running a big simulation every time I tweak the error model slightly, which is what I would have to be doing. So this led me back to the idea of block coding. Basically, thresholds on block coding rely on the fact that as the number of qubits increases, the frequency of errors approaches the expectation. In particular, in the limit that n goes to infinity, if you have some probability of error on a set of qubits, p, and that probability is less than the asymptotic correctable error fraction, tau, then the failure probability goes to zero. This is just the idea that a Gaussian becomes more and more p as the number of samples becomes larger. And so if you're on the right side of the cutoff, then eventually, as n becomes large enough, you'll never venture over. In this limit, the threshold criterion is simply that the encoded error rate goes to zero in the circuit, and the limit that n goes to infinity. Of course, there was a problem, I said, with using block codes. And that problem was that, one, we needed ancilla. And two, even if we have these ancilla, we have to find some way of analyzing it. And certainly, if I'm going for estimates, it sort of seems at the outset like doing Monte Carlo simulations on blocks is in the limit that the blocks go to infinity is a bad idea. In fact, though, what I'm going to tell you today is a way of doing a full counting of the possible errors, not on the entire block, but on the single line of the block. In order to do that, we need to alter our fault tolerant procedures a little bit, such that the procedure looks the same from every line. This is a property that I refer to as homogeneous. And basically, it just comes down to your fault tolerant procedure being both transversal and identical. That is an example that for gates is up here in the upper right. And the nice thing is that often fault tolerant procedures look this way anyway. The transversality is already there because that was the way we achieved fault tolerance. And the identical just comes from the property of CSS codes. So if you're using those, chances are it looks something like this.
Right, but you can't really keep this for the ancilla preparation.
Right, so you can't keep this for the ancilla preparation, and so you're going to need resources of a certain kind. And so the first part of the talk will be assuming that you have resources ancilla such that the errors on the individual qubits satisfy this sort of homogeneity property. And then we'll talk about not so much making them homogeneous, but making the ancilla at all in the second part of the talk. So as was just pointed out, in addition to the gates being homogeneous, we need all the resources used to satisfy the same property, in particular with regard to the errors, since that's what we really care about. And so for the next few slides, what I'm going to be talking about is this case in which also your input ancilla satisfy a homogeneity property with respect to the errors. In addition to this, I also assume some common things about the errors. For instance, that they're trace preserving, that is, there's no leakage, and that the errors look the same if you run them forward or backward in time, which is basically the statement that you're not being driven to some particular point coherently, such as the zero state. Well, once you've made the entire procedure homogeneous.
So how realistic is that unbiased assumption?
The unbiased assumption, the realism of the unbiased assumption depends very strongly on the system you're working with. I mean, there are some for which it's not realistic at all.
You know? Any example of both extremes?
One in which it's not realistic is when your primary mode of failure is due to emission, right? Because then you're never going to the excited state, basically. You're always going to the ground state. If your primary mode of failure is due to, say, over or under rotations of the qubits, then I mean, these things are fine.
So does that mean mutable, basically?
Yeah. So having made the rest of the, so having made the ancilla homogeneous, there's still one part of most fault-tolerant circuits which you might want to worry about, and that is error correction. As it turns out, though, we can treat error correction as homogeneous as well. The way this is accomplished is by realizing that while interpretation of the syndrome information requires some sort of complicated function on all the measurement outputs, actually, what we actually get out of this syndrome interpretation is just the knowledge of where the errors occurred or where some equivalent set of errors occurred. Now, for our purposes, this is just as good. Knowing some equivalent set of errors is just as good as knowing where the actual errors are. While this isn't a very sort of practical thing to ask, it's a perfectly acceptable thing to ask if you're trying to analyze the effect of learning the location of the errors. And the nice thing is that it's also completely homogeneous. And so you can just think about it from the terms of one qubit. If a qubit is an error and you're below the correctable fraction of errors, then it finds out. And if it's not an error, then it doesn't. So for the purposes of some sort of simulation, I can treat this again as homogeneous, and I don't have to take into account the states of the other qubits, aside from determining whether or not the probability, whether or not the entire state has failed.
Okay. it's somewhere. As far as I understood so far, homogeneity means transversality and invariance under permutations.
Mm-hmm.
Say you have a construction like that. If you apply the same permutation on the qubits up there in the ancilla and below, sort of the state remains invariant.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the question I want to ask, because you are from time to time referring to single qubits.
Mm-hmm.
Can you treat correlated errors in your model? Are you taking correlated errors properly into account?
Right. The errors of the gates are all assumed to be independent. And it's necessary that the ancilla errors also be independent. So if you start making correlated errors on the system, then no. I can't any longer just sort of pick out a single qubit and only analyze that.
Yeah, okay.
Because, what one qubit, what the error on one qubit is then dependent on the error on another qubit. And so what I'm doing in the end here is I'm just picking out a single line of a fault tolerant procedure. So, a strand, this line and this line, the ones that connect, the qubits that connect via gates. And then I'm looking at how errors propagate on those. So if I have to use multiple strands because I have coherent errors. So fortunately, whether or not some encoded state has failed or not is in the limit that the number of qubits goes to infinity, also a deterministic thing, because the number of errors in the system will approach the expectation. And so that can also be determined, given that all the qubits are identical, by looking at a single one. The final thing you might worry about here, actually, is just recovery. Because if we decide to recover things, we may, in fact, have errors on particular qubits and not on other. But conveniently, it's been pointed out by Mill that we never really need to do recovery. Once you know the location of polyerrors in some Clifford circuit, it's sufficient just to keep in mind that these polyerrors happen, and you can sort of track their effects throughout the circuit using error propagation. As Bob. And just take that into account when you do your measurements. As it turns out, you never really need to apply, it's often sufficient to apply Clifford gates. Nothing else gets applied to the data because these non-Clifford gates are applied via a sort of teleportation operation. So given this method of making the fault tolerant procedure homogeneous, we can then write down a method of threshold determination. And it's simply to consider a single strand of the fault tolerant procedure, that is a set of qubits that couple to each other by a two qubit gates, and by exhaustive counting and error propagation, that is, we're enumerating sort of every possible set of errors on that one strand, which I can't do, but the computer can do. We determine what the error probability is at every point in the circuit, given that all of the syndrome extractions, all the syndrome decoding succeed. After having done that, we then determine the maximum error probability of a bit flip error at any post-measurement location, that is, any place that we're actually trying to extract the location of the errors from the syndrome. And if that number is below the correct Poiré fraction, then the error rate is below the threshold. So what does this get you? I've made a couple of assumptions here. The big two are that logical ancilla of any size can be prepared, and that these ancilla are such that their error distribution is homogeneous. The first actually turns out to be the harder criterion to satisfy, because it's actually difficult to directly make ancilla of any size. I won't say impossible, but certainly difficult. But putting aside these assumptions for the moment, some possible applications of this work. Well, the obvious is a rigorous threshold surface for the resources I requested, that is, for ancilla with homogeneous errors. This turns out to be a fairly useful thing in that it provides a kind of simple metric for judging the effectiveness of various different procedures and how will they work for different kinds of error models. So the whole point of doing this originally was that it was an easy way to analyze different error models. It's also turned out to be an easy way to just kind of plug in different fault tolerant procedures and reduce thresholds for these kinds of resources. Here at the right, I have a set of thresholds in terms of the asymptotic correctable error fraction, which, you know, depending on how well you think you can correct very large codes, how much decoding you want to do, you can pick it yourself. And we see that the single coupling scheme, that is the sort of scheme procedure in which syndromes are extracted once, and the double coupling scheme, where the syndromes are extracted twice, and the telecorrection protocol, the kind proposed by Nil, we can then sort of compare how these do for different error models. And there are a number of interesting things you see from this. One of them is actually that extracting the syndrome twice for ancilla with these properties isn't as useful as you might think it would be. The only time where the double coupling scheme model really beats out the single coupling is when you have something like error model 2, where measurement errors are prevalent. Now, that's maybe not so shocking, because when Steen worked this out, really what he was thinking about was ancilla that only satisfy this property in sort of one error basis. So in the other error basis, now and again, you get something awful that didn't look anything like the ancilla that you were looking for. And in that case, it's actually very important to do this, this checking. Because if you don't, then you're going to wind up correcting a lot of errors that weren't really there, the result of one ancilla being having completely failed. So these two kinds of models, coupling, single coupling scheme and Nil's telecorrection, are better suited to the kind of assumptions I've been working with, where you have ancilla that satisfy these sort of nice properties, basically where you have very clean ancilla. Another interesting thing to take away from this chart is that the telecorrection under these circumstances actually beats out both the steam procedures in every case. And that's, I think, interesting and somewhat surprising.
Just a second here before we go to the next slide. Could you say a little bit about what these numbers mean? They are called.
So these are all thresholds
in units of the correctable error fraction. So please explain a little more.
I mean, right.
Maybe you could also say what the thresholds are in absolute terms.
Well, basically, in order to get these things, we're saying what fraction of errors we think we can correct on the quantum code, in the limit that the number of qubits goes to infinity, right? So if you think that you're willing to do say, asymptotic corrections, so you're actually trying to correct above the minimum distance, say, then that's going to go to 11% for CSS codes. If you think that you're only willing to correct up to minimum distance, then that's going to go to 5.5%. So these are coefficients that you multiply by these numbers. Okay. You may instead say, well, really what I want to be doing is min sum or some easy decoding algorithm, since I'm going to have so many qubits. And for some other decoding algorithm, you're going to need to look at what the asymptotic correctable fraction of errors is using that kind of decoding. So what fraction of errors you can actually correct in the limit that it goes to infinity.
Okay, suppose I do the usual thing. I have a concatenated code, and I just do the error correction level by level, as most people would do. I mean, it's an efficient classical procedure. Mm-hmm. Do I find these numbers here in this table, or are they for other methods?
So this is for block coding. So you're considering the code as a whole. Sort of the nearest thing for block coding to this standard concatenation thing is actually to look at minimum distance error correction for block coding. And that's going to give you, you're going to have to multiply 5.5% by all of these numbers for CSS codes.
Okay,
5.5%? So
that was for the kind of random CSS code minimum distance, which has nothing to do with concatenation.
Right, which has nothing to do with concatenation. But you're doing minimum distance error correction on both of them. I'm trying to find the nearest thing for a block code to the CSS concatenated code.
Well, it's maybe better to go the other around. I mean, concatenated code is a block code. You can say, well, with this, you know, the standard you're putting out level by level, there's some fraction of errors we can just correct. And presumably that's what you would plug in here.
That's true. That might actually be a better way to go about things. So rather than trying to say, well, they're both doing minimum distance decoding on a particular level, just say, well, if you do concatenated coding, what fraction of errors? Problem with that is, though, if you do concatenated coding, I mean, you're correcting zero as a fraction as n goes to infinity, right?
If you do, well, okay, so if you do worst case distribution of errors,
yeah.
But in fact, this is usually...
So we want to do an average.
That's right. So at least the average placement of errors, obviously up to the error model. In that case, they are, I mean, asymptotically, they have some tolerable error rate.
Right.
So just maybe a dumb question. I'm just doing error correction on my understanding of your talk. If your ancillae had no errors, perfect ancillae, would all those numbers go to 1? Like, you'd be able
Because we have gate errors in everything. You can set the ancilla and the gate errors separately. What I've done for this is I've set the ancilla errors to something that I thought was reasonable in terms of the gate errors. But no, even if the ancilla were perfect, these errors wouldn't be 0 because we're modeling gate errors. All of the operations. In fact, as it turns out, part of the reason why this is a useful thing to do is you can set all the ancilla errors to 0 and it doesn't even help that much. So kind of the point here is that the ancilla errors are not as important as you might think they were, so long as they're just not completely washing out the ancilla.
So you're setting the ancilla error something you thought was reasonable, which is kind of roughly what?
roughly, this is I'm setting the ancilla error such that you have at least the errors from both the control and the target end of control not gate applied to them. So we're assuming some sort of verification process, which you're kind of transversely coupling out. And at very least, I figured you won't be able to catch these last errors because there's no way to check for it.
Yes.
And so no matter how clever you are, you'll have that if you went and verified these ancilla in sort of the briefest possible
way. That's like 5 times the...
Yeah, something like
the error.
This all comes out of your question time.
I hope
you don't like the real time.
Yeah. No, that's great. God is not competition, right? So a slightly less obvious application is actually for estimating thresholds in the same way that people do with these Monte Carlos. And you get numbers, if you compare to the literature, that are roughly on the same order. These actually look a little better than they should, but you know, sometimes things look a little better than they should. The basic reason that this works is actually when you're producing these threshold estimates in the literature, you're kind of doing a similar thing in which you say, well, we want very good ancilla, and why not? Because it's only a constant overhead if you're doing some estimate, and it improves your threshold. And so the result is that in doing these estimates, you're making actually very nice ancilla. And so again, we can kind of mod out the effects of correlations and kind of similar assumptions apply as to those that I've used. Of course, the thing that you'd really like and the real long shot application is to use this kind of method as a recipe for actually achieving some threshold. That is, we'd actually want to make not infinitely sized blocks, but really big ones. And then we'd want to do quantum error correction and quantum computation using those. And so what I'll be talking about for the rest of the talk is my attempt to actually make not infinite, but reasonably large N-SELECT. So this is a problem for two basic reasons. The first is that as the number of gates applied, and that the number of gates applied to each qubit typically is going to scale with the total size of the ancilla. So rapidly, not as rapidly as the second problem, but rapidly, you're going to find that the probability of an individual qubit being an error is going to go to 1, just because we've applied so many gates to it, and we haven't actually looked for any problems. Long before this becomes an issue, however, we have a different problem, which is that in making these ancilla, we have to couple different qubits within a block. So this process isn't at all fault-tolerant. What this means is that if an error appears somewhere in the middle of some construction circuit, I've used a small construction circuit, and I'll use small examples for the rest of the talk. It's not because I'm really thinking about small examples, but it's because I can actually draw them on the board. So if an error appears somewhere in the middle of this construction circuit, and I'm not doing any error checking before the end, you see that by the end it can be actually quite a nasty error that maybe I don't know how to correct. So rather than working at this first problem, which just involves basically either reducing the number of gates or doing some concatenation-like procedure, I'm going to be looking at the second problem, which is trying to deal with the spread of errors while constructing and so on. As I said, both of them can actually be overcome, and they are overcome in the sort of standard concatenated coding method. And this is achieved simply by sort of correcting the layers again. So rather than having to worry about, well, we have such a big state that we've applied so many gates that something must have failed, instead we make little states and we check those, and then we make those into bigger states and so on and so forth. And so you don't have to go through so many steps prior to seeing if something's gone wrong. Unfortunately, this method is only applicable for kind of obvious reasons to codes that have a concatenated substructure. And I'd like to look at other codes for a variety of reasons that I've discussed. And so the next few slides will be talking about how I attempt to prepare ancilla for arbitrary codes. Of course, it won't actually be arbitrary ancilla, because I'm lazy. So instead, we'll start out by talking about preparing arbitrary stabilizer states. Now, it's a convenient fact about stabilizer states, actually, that they're all equivalent to graph states up to local Clifford operations. You can actually show that they're equivalent to graph states up to 3 local Clifford operations on each of the qubits. And 3 isn't really a number that we're worried about when talking about large ancilla, so I'm just going to ignore it completely, and we'll make graph states.
Sorry, what does that mean?
So if I prepare a graph state, and then within it, if I want to make a stabilizer state, it's sufficient to prepare some graph state, and then apply at most 3 local Clifford operations to each qubit. And that can get me to the desired stabilizer state.
I don't understand. I mean, you mean 1 of 3?
At most 3 local Clifford operations.
Per qubit? Uh-huh. Why not just apply them all at once?
You're right. I'm thinking of a particular set of Clifford operations that I like because they're in my gate set. It's true that you can condense them down into 1 Clifford operation. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah. There's six single qubit operations, and you're only using 3 of them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right. Sorry. Yeah, I'm thinking of a particular basis.
Okay.
I mean, you might imagine that I wanted some Clifford operation that, well, if you didn't know so much about Clifford, the Clifford group, you might imagine I wanted some Clifford operations so I had to apply to a bunch of these things. And all I'm saying is this is not the case. If you have sort of a very standard set, applying three of them is sufficient. So any stabilizer's generator can be put in the form of a sort of graph state stabilizer generator, and that's just one in which X is only a curl in the diagonal, and Z operators are symmetric across the diagonal. And the reason they're called graph states is that these states can be represented by a graph. I have a graph here in the upper right corner. And I think a graph is best thought of as a method of preparing states. So if you have some graph and you want to prepare the corresponding graph state, all you have to do that is you prepare all of the qubits in zero, you apply Hadamard to all of the qubits, and you apply controlled phase gates between every pair of nodes that are connected in the graph. You apply controlled phase gate between every pair of qubits corresponding to those. So eventually, we're going to want to be constructing graph states fault tolerantly. But first, it would be good to know a few properties of graph state construction in general. Now, it can be shown that any graph state can be constructed in at most a number of rounds that's equal to 2 times the floor of n over 2 plus 1. So the way to show this is actually by considering the complete graph and just showing that you can make the complete graph in this number of controlled phase gates, using this number of rounds of controlled phase gates. And since any other graph is just a complete graph with some gates left out, you can certainly make any other graph in this number of rounds as well. Of course, this preparation procedure isn't at all fault tolerant. If an X error occurs somewhere here in the procedure, then that will send Z errors flying to the far ends of the ancilla. It's interesting to note, though, that Z errors don't actually get propagated at all. And that's because controlled phase gates don't propagate Z errors, which will turn out to be the basis of the method that I'll describe to you.
Can you go back one?
Sorry.
My question is, it's also partly fault tolerance and my understanding, but in the what you're saying in order for this result is that you can compare, you can have a, you can perform order n of these controlled phase gates per round.
Yes, you have to have parallelism.
Yeah.
So yeah, you need to be able to apply n over 2 of these things every round. So every qubit must be capable of participating in a controlled phase gate in every round. Otherwise, it's going to scale up like it's squared. So our fault tolerant procedure is going to use some properties of the controlled Z gate. It has some very nice properties, including the fact that it commutes with the controls of any other controlled unitary, and that it commutes with Z operators or Z errors, and that if you commute the controlled phase gate through an X error, it's the same thing as the controlled phase gate with an X and a Z error on the other side. Okay. Basically, what I'm saying here is then that Z errors are not spread by controlled Z gates, and X errors only spread Z errors. So using this idea, we can construct a kind of logical circuit for fault-tolerant graph state construction. Each of these lines in this logical circuit represent a set of 5 qubits. Again, I'm dealing with a small case, so I can draw it. And you can see that this, assuming no errors happen, that this is exactly the construction procedure I showed you a minute ago. Because each of these R are the rounds that I listed on the previous graph. So these are blocks of controlled phase gates. And since controlled phase gates can commute with controls, we can just commute all of these control knots through, and they annihilate each other. And then we just have the bottom line without the control knots. And that's a set of Hadamards and then each of our controlled phase gate blocks. Now, if errors actually happen, and they're Z errors, they again just commute through. X errors, however, are going to be propagated up to the target end of these control knots, and we can see them when we do measurements. by looking at these X errors, since only X errors spread Z errors, we can then make some kind of estimate of where we think the Z errors were propagated to. That means that we're not going to be able to correct Z errors that occurred independently on the gates. So we're not going to be able to correct errors that occurred without spreading. But we will be able to correct Z errors that were sort of spread by X errors. In order to do this, however, we need to not have these kinds of correlations arising from the first part of the circuit where we prepare the cat states. So this piece will actually have to be prepared separately. It's shown here as one total circuit, that way you can actually see what's happening. Okay. So looking at these error tracks, we'll get something like this for, say, the 30-qubit ancilla. And we can then apply a filtering algorithm based on the probability of different kinds of errors. And we can guess at what our actual errors on the ancilla were. And we get error tracks that look something like that. So these are for X errors. And then on the basis of where we think there were X errors on the ancilla during preparation, we can guess at where there ought to have been Z errors on the ancilla. So this last graph shows the change. And so this is a summary for people who don't like circuits of what the graph state construction procedure is. And down here at the bottom, I have tabulated a preliminary list of properties. And this construction procedure appears to be such that the total number of residual X and Z errors are no more than twice the number of errors that occur. So if you consider that a Y error is also 1X and 1Z error, you can't really hope to do better by that metric. The residual error probability on the error scales like n, because n is the number of gates you apply. And so we're not actually doing any correcting for these independent errors. All we're actually doing is sort of tracking the correlated errors. And finally, the fact that the residual error probability scales like n puts a limit on the size that the base error probability can be if we actually want to succeed at constructing something. So this isn't a method of constructing something of any size. If you have a base error probability p, then this procedure will certainly fail if you're trying to make a ancilla of size larger than one of them. There are a number of things that I probably ought to talk about. But in the interest of time, I have omitted them. You can quiz me about them in the minute that I have remaining, if you so desire. Up here, I have sort of a roadmap of what I've done and what I'm doing, and one issue that I might want to look at in the distant future. Thank you very much.
Can you explain the road sign? The checks are things you've done?
Yeah, the checks are things I've done. Those are supposed to be little yellow picks. Yeah, I know. I made that myself, so maybe the art is not the best. These are things that I'm working at and have sufficient progress to actually think that they might work. And the red thing is something that I really want to think about at some point, but I haven't.
So I have a question regarding the four-Turing cluster state preparation. Uh-huh. You said you get a handle on phase errors, phase flip errors. And I wasn't able to see that right away from your construction. I mean, you had some xenons there, and they would propagate spin flip errors to the ancillas, which you would then measure. How do you get a handle on the phase flip errors again?
Right. So I'm not correcting independent phase flip errors. So what I'm trying to do in this procedure, remember I said that the problem that kicks in first when you're preparing these ancilla is that you're spreading errors everywhere. So what I'm trying to do is actually catch the phase errors that were spread by the bit flip errors, since only bit flip errors spread phase flip errors. So I'm just correcting for these correlated errors. The uncorrelated errors, that's the reason that we have this bound on the size of the unencoded error probability. Above that, even the uncorrelated errors are going to be enough to sink your ancilla construction.
So the phase flip errors you don't care about.
Right. I only care about the correlated errors. That's all I'm trying to fix with this.
Because it's great.
Yeah.
Okay, but then I would like to make a remark. So here's where you could be in trouble. So when you create a graph space, you are, maybe you want some stabilizer state, and instead you are creating one of the locally equivalent graph states. What you are not guaranteed is that in this equivalence class, there is a graph with a small degree. And if you pick a graph with a high degree, so one vertex has a high degree, then errors, let's just talk about phase errors here, they are accumulating at that vertex qubit. So, if you consider phase errors only, you may end up with a local error model, uncorrelated errors that you like, but still you can have large amounts of it if you have a large graph degree.
Large amounts of uncorrelated errors.
Yes.
Yes.
So that you're already in your ancilla, you may be above, if the degree is sufficiently large, you may be already above the error correction threshold, even under the assumption that your error correction is perfect.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And that is sort of the origin of this problem. And that if I apply enough gates, this is sort of, again, coming back to the idea of, if I apply enough gates, then if I didn't try to correct anything in between and I applied enough gates and they have a high enough error probability, then yeah, it won't work. Every qubit is going to fail.
And so Julian, this is why on the last slide you said moderately sized.
This is why I said moderately sized, because I certainly don't claim to be able to prepare something of any size. I've tried, but it's hard.
One last question before the break. Well, I just had a comment on the high degree nodes in the graph. In the kind of one-way picture of computation, you can pull apart a high degree node.
Does
it not?
That's an easy one.
All right.
Okay, so let's meet back here in 16 minutes, so 20 past 10, which is about 25 past 10 on that clock.